Welcome to the Hailsham Chambers Medical Law Podcast with me, Nick Peacock.
And me, Julian Picton.
Well, Julian, it's not often, is it, that cases about damages in clinical negligence litigation take first slot on the BBC News, but the case we're discussing today did just that, didn't it, on the 18th of February 2026. Julian, tell the listeners which case we are considering today, please.
Nick, we are today considering the case of CCC and Sheffield Teaching Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust.
Now, it's fair to say the dust has settled somewhat since the Supreme Court handed down its judgment, and events have rather overtaken the news about CCC as of, at least of early April 2026 when this episode is being recorded. What we're going to be doing today is, broadly speaking, as follows. In the first segment of this inaugural Hailsham Chambers Medical Law Podcast,
hear, hear,
we will give you a brief, and it will be brief, Julian promises me, exposition of the facts underlying the judgment, an explanation of the relatively narrow issue which the Supreme Court was asked to determine, and have a look at what the court in fact decided. We will then have something of an intermission, bringing you news from the wider Hailsham Chambers diaspora. And after that, we'll return to CCC and have a look at the much more interesting questions surrounding what the court didn't decide and the implications for clinneg damages now and in future. So, exciting times, ladies and gentlemen. But first, Julian, turning to the facts of CCC, can you give us a pithy, please, explanation of the underlying facts of the case and the decision?
Nick, I'll do my best to be pithy. As you know, it is my wont. Narrowing things down to the absolute minimum in order to understand exactly what the Supreme Court had to decide, the facts are as follows. I should say, qualifying that statement, there is, as is often stated, no substitute for reading all the judgments.
Hear, hear.
CC is a birth injury claim. As a result of her injuries, the claimant's life expectancy was severely reduced. It was reduced to the age of 29. But for the clinician's negligence, the claimant's life expectancy would have been normal. It was agreed by the parties that but for her injuries, the claimant would have got a job in a similar line of work to that of her mother and her aunts, and that she would have worked until normal state retirement age. The parties were able to agree the multiplicand for the claimant's loss of earnings claim to the age of 29, and that claim, by agreement, came to £160,000, which frankly doesn't sound an awful lot. But it left over the period of 39 years, by my maths, from the age of 29 until normal retirement, when the claimant would have been earning a living, but which, because of her abbreviated life expectancy, would now post-date her death. They were the so-called lost years. Because of the Court of Appeal's decision in Croke and Wiseman, decided as long ago as 1982, which had concluded that awards for the lost years didn't apply to cases where the claimant was a young child, the claimant accepted that the trial judge couldn't award her anything for the 39 years of her uninjured working life occurring after her death, and instead sought permission to appeal the result. The trial judge, with a following wind behind him, granted a certificate for a leapfrog appeal straight to the Supreme Court so that the claimant could challenge the Court of Appeal's decision in Croke and Wiseman. The Supreme Court concluded, with, it must be said, a bit of to-ing and fro-ing along the way, that Croke and Wiseman was wrongly decided and sent CCC all the way back to Mr. Justice Ritchie, for it was he, to assess the damages for the lost years. It follows, Nicholas, that for the time being at least, note, there is no longer a bar in principle to infant claimants recovering a lost year's award.
Now, look here, I've heard about leapfrogs and a case called Croke, and for the whole of my working lifetime, I was convinced it was Crook and Wiseman. Which of us, Julian, is right?
Well, Nicholas, you're an eloquent speaker in all terms, but I'm afraid to say on this one, I completely disagree with you. I'm sticking to the phonetics. It's Croke. I prefer croaks who are better than crooks.
Well put. I see what you did there.
Yes, it was rather good.
Now, look, the narrow issue then, which the Supreme Court was asked to decide, is basically what?
Well, they were only allowed to decide a very narrow issue. To understand precisely what was left over to them, you've got to go a little bit into the past history of this particular issue, and specifically to the case of Pickett and British Rail Engineering. Pickett was a mesothelioma case, and in it, the House of Lords overturned the Court of Appeal's decision in Oliver and Ashman, allowing a claim for the lost years brought by an adult claimant who was in his 50s and who had a very short life expectancy, indeed so short that he died before the appeal was heard, leaving a wife and young children unprovided for immediately. That may be important, we'll come back to that. It's fair to say the House of Lords didn't make clear whose loss they were trying to compensate for. Depending on whose speech you read, it was either the injured claimant's loss in the form of a reduction in the value of his earning capacity attributable to the abbreviation of his life expectancy, or it was loss as sustained by his dependents as a result of his premature death. They also gave us no real guidance on the correct method of computing the deduction for living expenses, the multiplicand for the lost years, or the adjusted multiplier for the entire loss of earnings claim, both before and after death. The issue in CCC was limited in scope because the parties apparently agreed they were only interested in the status of Croke and Wiseman and whether or not it was consistent with the decision in Pickett. The Supreme Court was not given the chance to revisit what we might think of as the much more fundamental question, should there be damages for lost years at all?
Okay. Recap. Lost years are claims in which a claimant whose life expectancy has been made shorter by the defendant's negligence claims for loss during the period between his likely, though premature, death and the date on which he or she would have died but for the negligence. Have I got that right?
Yes.
So far, so good. Now, look, of course, sometimes lawyers, though not the presenters of the already semi-legendary Hales from Chambers Medical Law podcast, take arcane points of law for the sake of it. Julian, what was at stake financially on this appeal?
Well, I think there are two answers to that question, Nick. The first is what was pleaded. The claimant's pleaded lost years claim came to something like £800,000, so it's not an inconsiderable sum.
Worth litigating for.
Well worth litigating for. I don't think that's what the claimant's going to end up with because the parties agreed a much, much lower multiplicand. I don't know what the total will be, but it looks as though it would be much closer to £200,000 than to £800,000. Not negligible money, but not quite as much as the claim on paper appeared to be worth.
Do you mean to say that the schedule was pleaded at a value higher than the claimant might expect to receive? Because that would be almost a first.
It would be inconceivable, so I couldn't possibly comment.
All right. Now, before we reach the intermission, or is it perhaps an interlude, again, on the very narrow point which the court was asked to determine, what did it say, but more importantly, why, perhaps?
Well, what it said was that Croke and Wiseman was wrongly decided. I'm not really sure that it said a great deal more than that. What it raised was a series of questions which take us into the second segment of this now legendary podcast and really cover where everything is going to go. In other words, where might we end up if only the Supreme Court get asked the question they really wanted to be asked?
For my money, for what it's worth, and I'm a bear of very small legal brain, I was entirely unsurprised that a court eventually said Crook and Wiseman, for it is Crook, was wrongly decided.
Don't you think we should have a T-shirt printed with Croke or Crook and Wiseman, Nick?
Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here first. Watch the Hailsham Chambers website for details of the T-shirt coming out soon. The line drawn between a child and an adult, although set in stone by law at the age of 18, it seems to me completely arbitrary and for the purposes of these lost years income claims. I mean, if you can calculate and in this case agree the basis for lost earnings to the date on which the claimant will die and agree, as in this case, the date on which the claimant will die, why all of a sudden should a court be invited with a straight face to regard the task beyond the agreed date of death as too hard or too speculative?
Well, that's where I think we're going to go and have a look in segment number two, Nick, because it won't surprise you to know that I have, shall we say, a few suggestions to make on those very interesting lines of inquiry.
Now, hold on to your seats, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, my goodness me, yes.
Part two, imminent. Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the intermission of the Hailsham Chambers Medical Law Podcast. And I'm delighted to have with us today our very first special guest on the podcast, Catherine Ewins. Welcome,
thank
Catherine.
Thank you, Nick.
Nice to see you here.
Extremely impressed at your technical ability, I have to say, Nick. So well done. Very good.
Time will be the judge of that. I fear I'm a useless engineer.
Not at all.
Well, look, Catherine, a few questions for today. Let's kick off with an easy one. Tell us why you chose to specialise in clinical negligence, what it is that you like about it.
Well, I was always very interested in medicine. I must say I would have liked to have been a doctor, but I can't stand the sight of blood, so that was out. But I now really love working with the eminent experts that we all see from day to day. I'm always pleased to hear from them that the clinical negligence work that we do does in fact increase the medical knowledge by crossing ideas between specialisms, etc. And I really like helping people. I think it's a very human topic. Whichever side you're working for, I think you are helping people. That's really important to me.
And you happen to be spectacularly good at the job, Catherine.
No, not at all, Nick. You're too kind.
Well, listen, what do you consider to be some career highlights to date?
Well, I think any trial, and I've done some reasonably big trials, which has been a great privilege. I do enjoy the cross-examination and trial work once all the prep is done, I have to say. But I do enjoy also the tactics of negotiating. So that's always greatly a privilege in our day-to-day work. But I think one of the big cases that I was involved in, I was very lucky to be involved in the Patterson litigation. And now the inquests arising out of treatment performed by Ian Patterson, the breast surgeon from the Midlands, in the civil litigation, there were about 800 odd claimants. That ultimately settled, and now there are 60 inquests opened in respect of deceased patients. I think such large cases, by their very nature, throw up very significant issues of many kinds. And the work is fascinating when there's such a breadth of matters that you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. So I've been very, very lucky indeed.
Well, now, you've recently become head of the medical law group here at Hailsham Chambers. Congratulations.
Thank you.
any plans for the next couple of years?
Well, I think Hailsham has always had a lot of expertise in a wide range of subspecialties of clinical work, if you like, whether it be mental health or inquests or group litigation or a particular type of surgery. And I think it would want to make sure that people are aware of that expertise. I think it's also important that we develop further the links we have with the firms that we work with, both claimant and defendant. We're extremely lucky to have such good and lovely solicitors we work with. I hope you're listening, everybody. And it's important that the more junior members of chambers are introduced to those firms, I firmly believe. You can't possibly instruct them if you don't know our great team in chambers. So important generally, I think, to share our expertise with solicitors. It's quite a tough line of business. And I feel that if we all share our information, it makes matters much easier.
Okay, well, look, trick question here. If there's one aspect of clinical negligence litigation which you could change, whether law or procedure, overnight, what would that be?
I've got a particular bugbear for me is the fatal accident acts, the definition of or the categories of person that can get bereavement damages. It seems to me that it's always been wrong that there should be such a narrow group of persons, spouses and children, which receive them. Why shouldn't a parent of a child aged 20 get bereavement, or indeed a child of a parent who's 50, say? Just seems to be wrong.
And there was a time when the Human Rights Act was sought to be used to overcome some of those problems.
That well, there have been declarations of incompatibility, but that's not gone further and the law has not been changed. So I would need to get into Parliament, which is not going to happen, I'm afraid.
Well, who knows, Catherine? I wouldn't like to predict that. But what I can predict is that the semi-legendary Hailsham Chambers Medical Law podcast will be covering the Fatal Accidents Act.
Some
aspects of it in the very near future. So yes, please watch this space.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, look, Catherine, your work ethic is legendary, but I have it on very high authority that outside work, you're a committed and very competent baker. And I know that because you told me so yourself.
Oh, dear, that's terrible.
So answer this. If you were competing in the Hailsham Chambers Bake Off final, what do you think your signature dish would be?
Well, Nick, I'm not sure I've got signature dishes. I do very, very basic cooking. I am passionate about cooking and I do loads of puddings and I do bread every week. But the thing is, it's all very basic. I grow fruit and veg and my mother taught domestic science and so we never had processed food of any kind, which was a great, terrible thing for children. But I've now realised the benefits of it and I continue that. But my children will say, well, we have apple pie or apple crumble every single day between about October, September and March. And that's, they moan about it, but I love it, quite frankly. And I think it's very good for us. And it seems to me it's slightly better than my mother, who says that when she was growing up, they had apple and custard one day and custard and apple the next. So in any shape or form, my cooking is basic, but I do think it's good for us.
All
That's
right.
the main thing.
Well, look, Catherine Ewan, thank you very much indeed for being the first guest on the on the Hailsham Chambers Medical Law podcast. And in just a moment, we shall revert to part two with me and Julian Picton. See you in a moment. Thank you. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to part two of the Hailsham Chambers Medical Law podcast with me, Nick Peacock.
And me, Julian Picton.
Still, excellent.
Yeah, I haven't changed.
In which we are talking about CCC and Sheffield Teaching Hospitals NHS Trust, a judgment of the Supreme Court handed down in February 2026. And a reminder that this inaugural Hailsham Chambers Medical Law podcast was recorded in April 2026. Now, in this section, we are going to have a look at what the court didn't decide, and indeed some practice points and many questions raised by the judgment. What that means in effect is that I shall pose some questions which Julian will then go on to answer.
Or try to.
Now, let us start, Julian, with the big one. It didn't take very long into the judgment before a pretty heavy hint was dropped that the Supreme Court would quite like to have a crack at the whole issue of whether damages for the lost years should be awarded at all, did it?
It certainly didn't take them long, but I'm going to turn the tables and do the questioning now. Nicholas, what's the answer? Should they be awarded?
I'm bad to say I'm torn by this, because my sense had always been that damages for lost years are awarded to living claimants in order to compensate their dependents, although it's fair to say I have not thought through whether they are actual or putative dependents, because subsequent claims by dependents, once the original claimant has died, are conventionally considered to be barred by Section 1 of the Fatal Accidents Act 1976, where the claim is settled in the original victim's lifetime. And I think in my head I can see a justification for lost years claims providing compensation to dependents in that way. However, CCC tells me I'm wrong about that. On the other hand, if I try and subject lost years claims to any sort of legal scrutiny, and I remind listeners that I am a bear of very small legal brain, I run into the buffers pretty quickly. I do not see how they are a natural extension of damages in tort. Again, I am told by judges no lesser than Lord Wilberforce, amongst others, that I'm wrong about that too. So I give in, Julian. Please help.
Well, I'll give it a try. And I think the best place to start in this trail of rediscovery is to turn to the Oracle, our former colleague, indeed, good friend, Harvey McGregor, QC. Harvey, in a memorable phrase, says the following: wages in heaven should not be awarded when they're not needed on earth.
He had a very good turn of phrase, didn't he?
He certainly did. That's a composite phrase which contains so many of the things that we need to tease out. And I've spent quite a lot of time trying to do the teasing. It's quite difficult to pin down why Lost Year's awards are wrong in principle, but I think I've just about got there. I think what we're dealing with, the thing that makes us uneasy, the thing that causes you to be torn, is an unresolved conflict between but-for causation in its most, frankly, simplistic form, and the even more fundamental principle of English common law that you can't bring a claim if you're dead. I think there are three key elements to the analysis which you've got to look at and then apply.
I fear you're going to list all of them.
I certainly am. Fear not. First of all, there has to be an identifiable loss. Secondly,
check.
The loss has to have been suffered by the person claiming it.
Check.
And thirdly, that person has got to be alive at the time the loss was or will be incurred.
Check, I think.
If you apply those three requirements to Lost Year's claims brought by a claimant with no actual dependents, and that I think is important, the whole thing collapses under its own weight.
Do you think this is what I was getting at when I had not in my own head resolved the question as to actual or putative dependents?
I think that's precisely the point. And I think that's, although not consistent with these decisions, one of the key distinctions to draw. If we apply my three analytical points to an infant claimant's Lost Year's claim, it's questionable if there's an identifiable loss at all, because we're dealing with putative dependence, not actual dependence. If there is one, it hasn't been suffered by the person bringing the claim, because by definition, it isn't the claimant who's lost anything. It's the dependence they might conceivably have had in other circumstances. Hmm. If there could be a loss, it would only ever be incurred by the time the claimant is dead and could therefore not bring proceedings to recover it.
Okay. Lord Burroughs addresses many of those points in his very interesting judgment. If this case came before, or at least if a Lost Year's case came before a 7-justice Supreme Court, which was allowed to dissect, address and adjudicate on the whole principle of Lost Years in toto, what, Julian, will they decide?
Well, I'm going to stick out my neck quite a long way, Nick. I think Lord Burroughs has considerable sympathy with Harvey's point. In my view, if the right question, and it wasn't the right question this time, finds its way back to the Supreme Court, I think the court will decide that awards must be based on actual loss, that unless there are living dependents when damages are assessed, there can be no loss to compensate, and that in the case of claims by claimants with no actual dependents, whatever their age, there can be no Lost Year's claim. I go further, actually.
No, surely not.
You know me, ever on the edge. I think the Supreme Court will do away with Lost Year's claims in their current form entirely. We might, just to finish the thought, end up with a revision to them, recrediting the loss to the claimant themselves by evaluating the claim as the reduction in the value of that claimant's earning capacity as a result of their abbreviation in life expectancy. But I think that will take us to some form of conventional award, a little bit like Smith and Manchester, and therefore save, not that this would of course be the reason for doing it, the government, the state and insurers potentially very large sums of money, because of course CCC will lead to enormous numbers of claims that previously couldn't have been entertained.
And it is fair to say, of course, that the Supreme Court did not determine the method of quantification of lost years claims in these circumstances, did it?
No, it certainly didn't. And Lord Burrows leaves open the possibility, this was raised, of course, by Lord Wilberforce in Pickett, of valuing the damage to the injured claimant's earning capacity as the way to fit this particular bill. But the Supreme Court in CCC left open precisely how you calculate, even though they appear to have preferred the multiplier multiplicand approach, as I think they tended to call it. They left open specifically, amongst other things, the size of the discount for that proportion of the lost earnings which the claimant would have spent on themselves.
Yep.
The doors are open.
Yeah,
no one has actually stepped over the threshold.
Yeah, and of course, it's got to come back before Mr. Justice Ritchie for an actual calculation of the value of the claim. I suppose that might be compromised. There might be a judgment on contested evidence, and that in turn might be subject to appeal. Who knows? In the meantime, Julian, of course, as practitioners, we've got to wrestle with these concepts in the absence of a concluded view as to the method of quantification. There will be claims which are coming to settlement meetings soon. There will be claims which have settled and are yet to be approved by the court. What do we do in the meantime?
Well, the short answer is claimants will want more money. Both of us have had, I certainly have, a number of cases where we've reached settlement subject to court approval, maybe in the back end of last year, where all bets are now off.
Yeah.
Because we cannot, for claimants, contemplate ignoring the outcome in CCC, and those claimants will want more money from the defendant. In cases where we haven't quite got to that stage because we haven't had the RTM yet, plainly, if they're infant claimants whose schedule would otherwise have been silent on this point, there's going to be some rapid amendments made, and claims consistent with CCC will end up being incorporated amongst the other heads of loss. The short point at the moment is damages recovered by claimants will increase.
And I suppose it is open to defendants to set out all the arguments on quantification which Lord Burrows suggested remain open and on which we have no adjudicated case to date.
That's absolutely right. Turning the tables round and saying, what can a claimant do, a defendant can do to defend themselves.
Yeah.
I think their routine is to look at the amount of money the claimant would have spent out of the gross total of their annual income. The defendant need not assume that the conventional 50% deduction is apt, and particularly in lower earning claimants, that may not be enough.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there are many, many unresolved questions arising out of the judgment in CCC. But ladies and gentlemen, here endeth the inaugural episode of the Hailsham Chambers Medical Law Podcast, in which we have been looking at some of the questions raised by CCC and Sheffield Teaching Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust. Questions answered, questions unanswered, and the potential, according to Julian Picton, for pronunciation-themed T-shirts. Julian, where, for the listeners, is the best place for advice on these thorny unresolved issues?
At last, Nick, you raise a question I think I can answer. It is, of course, Hailsham Chambers, the paradigm repository of no-nonsense legal advice and what I like to think of as the fifth emergency service.
Wise words. Thank you, everyone. See you, see you very soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This podcast was brought to you by the Hailsham Chambers Medical Law Group. The presenters were Nick Peacock and Julian Picton, KC. Produced by Jamie Harley, this podcast comprises legal commentary, not legal advice. All rights reserved.